Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCain. Today we're talking about leadership lessons from parenting. People often seek to learn about leadership from warriors like Sun Tzu, the Chinese general who wrote The Art of War, and from successful businessmen like Tom Peters. But there's a fantastic training ground in leadership skills closer to home, raising children. Our guest today has written a book about that, called If You've Raised Kids, You Can Manage Anything, Leadership Begins at Home. Anne Crittenden is an award-winning journalist, author, and lecturer. Her latest book, If You've Raised Kids, You Can Manage Anything, received critical praise and was featured in People magazine. Her previous book, The Price of Motherhood, received widespread media attention and was named a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Crittenden was a reporter for the New York Times, writing on a broad range of economic topics. She initiated numerous investigative reports and was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She has also been a financial writer and foreign correspondent for Newsweek, a reporter for Fortune magazine, a visiting lecturer for MIT and Yale, an economics commentator for CBS News, and executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Her articles have appeared in every national newspaper and numerous magazines, including Foreign Affairs, The Nation, and Working Woman. A native of Dallas, Texas, Crittenden is a graduate of Southern Methodist University and the Columbia University School of International Affairs. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has served on the board of the International Center for Research on Women. She is married, has one son, and lives in Washington, D.C. Anne Crittenden, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. I'm delighted to be here.
Yes, and I love your book, If You Raise Kids, You Can Manage Anything, because leadership does begin at home. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners what inspired you to write this book.
Well, it was deeply personal, let me tell you.
Yeah.
I was a reporter for the Times when I got pregnant and had the baby. I took a maternity leave, and I was just gobsmacked, really, by a number of things. Number one, I was madly in love with this long-awaited baby, very wanted child. And so I threw myself into it, and I could not believe, number one, how challenging the work was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost... thought about it culturally as babysitting, but I realized, you know, you need every skill you can get your hands on. It requires the talents of a teacher, a psychologist, all kinds of things. I found a great quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "In dealing with my child, my Latin and my Greek, my accomplishments and my money stead me nothing. But as much soul as I have availed."
Ah, that's beautiful.
So, it is so great. And so that was number one. I thought, this is way higher work than I had ever imagined. And then the second immediate also surprise was that no one else seemed to think this. All my previous, you know, world of affairs and power and money and all of that stuff I was covering as an economics reporter, none of those people thought this was serious work at all. So the discrepancy was so vast, I thought, you know, I really should write about it. And that decision was reinforced when we had just moved to Washington from New York, and I was at a Washington cocktail party. And I like to joke that bragging about your skills as a mother at a Washington cocktail party is like bragging about your skills at group sex in a church social in the Midwest. So it's not
right.
You know, you really don't want to do. Anyway, a man came across the room, and he was very nice. He wasn't trying to put me down, but he said, "Hey, didn't you used to be Ann Crittenden?" And I thought, you know, I think I still am, but I really need to write about this other world and raise the, you know, consciousness, raise awareness of how really important the work of raising a kid is.
Yeah, that's so great. And your experience there really mirrors my own. I had been kind of up and coming in politics and government in Massachusetts and assistant secretary of state and managed statewide campaigns successfully. So like on a skyrocket up, and then we adopted a special needs girl. And I've realized that would take all my time and attention. So really focused on that. And I had a similar kind of experience, and it's just like it was the hardest thing by far I've ever done. And yet, when I would go and people would say, oh, what are you doing? I would say, well, you know, right now I'm full-time taking care of my daughter and my household. And I would have people with me who would be embarrassed for my behalf and rush in and go, oh, no, but she was Assistant Secretary of State and did all these things. I'm like, well, really, this is what I'm doing now, and I'm actually very proud of it, and it's hard.
I know. It's a lot of people have had that experience, I must say. And that's what really, you know, it was just a huge motivation to tackle that. And one of the really interesting angles, I did a ton of research, and that was first I put together The Price of Motherhood, which looked at the value of the work of raising kids and then how we don't place any economic value on it. But in the course of that reporting, I ran across a very intriguing fact. I noticed that in the baby books, talking about, you know, how to raise your best lessons of child rearing and all that, they were exactly the same as the management books, which I was familiar with from being an economics reporter. The books on how to manage people were just the same stuff, practically, as the books on how to raise a kid. So this is just no joke. And I ended up interviewing a man who'd written a very big bestseller called Getting to Yes back in the 80s. And he was running a seminar at Harvard on how to manage difficult people for middle-level managers and military officers and, you know, mid-career executive types. And I had lunch with him during these three-day seminar, and I said, I hope you're not going to be offended, but I'm going to compare what you're saying with the baby books. It's the same material. And he said, oh, yeah, no, I'm not offended. It all comes from Haim Gnaut and Abe Maslow, you know, these two humanistic psychologists, same stuff. So pretty interesting, I might say.
Yeah.
But he never gave any credit to Haim Gnaut or Abe Maslow or any of those psychologists. He was quoting, like you said earlier, Sun Tzu, Clausewitz, very military, male, masculine sources for his lessons, you know. So I like to joke that these guys who were paying thousands of dollars for this seminar, thinking they were learning the arts of war and all that, were actually could have found the same material in a $10 paperback on how to raise kids.
Right, exactly. Well, but
true.
It's very telling. You know, here he is giving a seminar at Harvard and charging a couple of thousand dollars, and all these very serious high-level executives are going, and he feels like he shouldn't reveal that that's some of the sources that he's using. And
right.
It's a testimony, I think, to how undervalued the whole area of parenting is, even though the richness that you're talking about on experience and management, you know, the incredible richness in the parenting experience, it's just amazing what a training ground it is. So, and you, with your interviews with over 100 parents, talk to them. You're talking to mothers and fathers both about how being a parent impacts them and informs them in the workplace. And what did you find out? Like, what are some of the lessons in leadership that parents learn when they're raising children that can help them in a workplace?
Well, I think one of the first ones that you run across in every child-rearing guidebook and business success is listening, really listening to people and listening to their concerns with respect. You know, everyone wants respect. And I heard that from, you know, remember Governor Ann Richards of Texas raised four kids before she went into politics. And she said this was the most important thing. She had learned never to let anybody leave the dinner table without being heard. They needed to be heard. and nothing was more important in politics. Every interest group, everybody needs the ear of the leader. So I thought that was pretty basic. There were other things that were more obvious. For instance, the business of managing a million things at once. You know, everybody does credit parents with, or particularly mothers, of being able to juggle a whole lot of things at once, multitasking. And I heard a lot of stories about that. Parents do that. I mean, I had a congresswoman talk about her four D's. She had to raise her own three kids and then four more or something of her sister who had died. So her rules were, first D, don't do it unless it's really necessary. Don't feel you have to do everything. Dovetail it, do a couple of things at the same time, or delay it, and maybe the problem will go away, the issue will solve itself. Or finally, just delegate it. You know, don't think you have to do everything. And she had some funny stories about that. And then, again, when you read the management books, you find out that the top executives do these things. This is how they operate. They don't sit around theorizing, how are we going to build this company in 5 years? Maybe they do a little of that, but basically they're running around solving problems as they come up, and they come up all at once in crisis mode, all of that. So that the way a real executive operates is very much the same way a busy parent operates. Excuse me. I'm afraid I'm getting a cold, so that's...
Oh. Yeah, well, I think that's a great place to start, is that, you know, that deep listening with respect is just so important for any leader. And the multitasking, I mean, people kind of almost in a way equate multitasking with parenthood, because you know, there's always several things going on at once, and it's very hard to focus uninterrupted in any one thing because, you know, something else is going to pop up. So those are some great skills. And the other thing you mentioned about in this wonderful book is the perspective that it gives you, that, you know, things that might have thrown you for a loop or you might have thought were so critical before, you actually get a better perspective and go, well, it's actually not a life and death issue and we don't have to sweat the small stuff. And by the way, it's almost all small stuff.
I know. I think that's really true. I heard that from a number of parents, that they felt when a really big crisis hit in the office, they always had that part of themselves that could say, all right, it isn't the end of the world. You know, the end of the world is if something happened to my kid. I can handle this, you know. So that's a good one, I think, too. And also in a crisis, one thing that's similar to parenting, I think, is that a leader has got to be there when the crisis hits. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, if there's a hurricane or a big natural crisis, the king, the president, the prime minister has to run to the scene. And we know they don't do anything, really. They're just there. But the fact that they're there symbolizes the fact that they care, that they're going to get it all organized, they're going to respond to the problem. And I think the very same thing is what you learn as a parent. You don't say, okay, I don't have time to take your phone call, or, oh, you want to talk to me, but I'm busy right now. A parent has to be there. And the kid has to know that they can come to them and they can count on them. And, you know, they're going to be there. I even had one child rearing expert tell me that she and her husband would always stay at home until their young teenager left the house, so that the kid left the house knowing the parents were there. And then they would run out the door.
That's remarkable.
You know, I know. But they just didn't want, you know, the kid to sense that something was more important.
Right.
Or they weren't backing them up, you know.
Right. And there was always a home and the parents were there. It's like a sense of security for the child.
Right. And the same thing goes with leadership. I heard that over and over again. If a guy indicates, or a female boss, whoever, indicates they just really aren't available to their staff or to their underlings, that's just really bad. And it's not good for morale. And you don't get the best out of people, you know.
Right. And speaking of getting the best out of people, I was really struck in your book about the number of parents who talked about, well, I have to deal with my child throwing tantrums, you know, the terrible twos or even difficult teenagers, but that training was actually very helpful even in the workplace. In the workplace, we have so many people who exhibit childish behavior. And
you know, I think we see that all the time, don't you?
Oh, yeah, well, we've got a full-blown case in the White House right now. But
somebody said if you just run around assuming everybody you meet is basically emotionally 4 years old, you can't go wrong. I mean, really, it does give you a little insight on how to deal with some of these tantrums.
Right.
I think people who have kids really know that. And when they know it, they see it, they know it.
Right, yeah. And in particular, some of the women working in the entertainment industry, and I hadn't quite put this together before, but they talk about if you're an actor or an actress or, you know, high-level director or whatever, that it's almost like your job to be really demanding, and you want to make sure you're as demanding as the other person is, or that means they're higher in the pecking order than you are. And it I think there are a lot of those.
Oh, if you're not as demanding, you're not as high up. Is that it?
That's it. Exactly. You're not as big a star. So.
Or I heard a story. I interviewed one Hollywood producer, and she said, you know, there was one guy who did a meltdown because he didn't have the parking space that indicated what he thought was his status. You know, when he came into the studio lot, he wanted the right parking space, and he threw a fit when he thought he was getting not a good one, you know. So what do? You know, well, you deal with it the same way you deal with your three-year-old. Oh, we'll fix it. We'll get you a nice one. You know,
yeah, we'll take care of it. Don't worry about it.
Whereas maybe a guy who hadn't raised kids might just get his back up and, you know, say, well, what are you doing? You're crazy, you know. No, you know how to humor it and get it all settled, you know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and then another aspect of parenting that's helpful in the workplace is this idea of recognizing each person's capabilities and encouraging them to be and to do their best. And that's certainly what we try to do with our children. And if you're a manager, you don't have to be a top-level executive even, but if you're, you know, in any way managing and working with other people, that is a great perspective to bring to your work relationships.
No question about it. My best interview on that score, well, the person who talked about that first for me was a senior manager engineer at Texas Instruments, and she had a phrase for it. She called it growing human capabilities. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you're raising kids, you definitely want them to be their very best and express themselves. And she made the point that not every child is the same. You know, from having more than one child, they're all different. They all have different strengths, and you don't ask one whose strength is being with other kids but no good at math to be the math genius, or you don't ask them to do the things they can't do. You ask them to be the best in the things they can do. And she said, you assume that everybody wants to do well. It's a trick, though, to help them do well at what they can do well. And that's good parenting. It's just fundamentally good parenting. And the same, she said, is true in the workplace. You can't ask everyone to do the same job in the same way. They're going to do it their way, or they're going to be different skills in your crowd. So just encourage that. And when you do, you're going to absolutely get the best out of everybody. And you'll have a much stronger organization. It just sounds like common sense. But not a lot of managers really know how to do that. And part of it also is having the guts to let people make their own mistakes. Too much hands-on parity, and the kids don't ever have make any of their own decisions or make any little errors, you know, mistake. They're not going to learn. You learn from your mistakes. So you have to have the nerve to let people get out there and do it their way. And maybe it won't work the first time, but they will learn if you have the skill to let them do it. As she put it, the parenting condition is one long exercise in letting go, in letting children gradually discover their own strengths and find their own way. And they can only do it by trial and error. You can't control everything. So, and I found another good quote from Meg Whitman, who was the CEO of eBay. She's just one of the most powerful women in American business there for a few years. She said, executive leadership is a span of influence, not of control. You can't control people. And that is important to know in child rearing. You learn it at your hazard if you try to overly control. And, you know, whatever. That's really a good one, I think.
Yeah, that's really good. I think that really encapsulates really some of the shift that's happened in what leadership means, too. You know, 50 years ago, it was much more of a command and control view of leadership, both within the workplace.
And in the parenting.
And in the parenting. Yeah, the father in charge, father knows best. They even had a show about that, name that. And that was how it was done. And now we know, well, you know, that really is not a great model because mother sometimes knows best, and mother knows a lot of different things than father knows. And it's better when everyone's working in a partnership and in a win-win frame, not in a I'm going to dominate and control you frame, which is bound to get resistance, resentment, and hostility.
It backfires. I mean, I'm really intrigued at talking about this at this particular historical moment because we seem to be in a period of real backlash of, you know, this reassertion of authoritarianism in government levels. And I don't know about corporations, but certainly we have this patriarchal, you know, male model control reasserting itself. I hope it's the last gasp of this. In the middle of what we really know culturally doesn't really work. I mean, look at Hong Kong and rebellion, you know, against this tough Chinese thing. It might not end very well, but it certainly indicates people don't want this type of control. And, you know, I don't have to say more, but around the world we're seeing these authoritarian figures. Even though we know it's the most dysfunctional, it creates backlash, it creates bad morale, it creates resentment, and it creates sabotage, really. So, I don't know. I hope our cultural awareness that this more congenial or more, what's the word for it, what I'm talking about? I don't want to say feminine because a lot of men do practice these techniques. Of
it's management. More a model of partnership than domination.
More partnership model or more just the thing I was saying of encouraging people to do their best and to encourage the people to do their own, show their own excellence in working in a team or working in an organization. It's way better. But we will see. I think we're kind of in a moment where there's a battle going on between these this understanding and what is being tried right now, you know. But when I read my material over again, I did this research a few years ago. I thought to myself, my God, you know, we do need a leader who's been a parent. We need someone who understands this, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. It's amazing. And, you know, I've felt that way anyway, but reading your book gives all the research and empirical data and rationale why that's true, is that we absolutely do need a leader who's a parent in the model that you're talking about. And I'm with you. I hope this backlash of authoritarianism is kind of a last gasp. And I'm hoping that the positive models that you're talking about for both parenting and leadership in the workplace will have taken root enough that there will be a huge backlash against this effort for domination and control and authoritarianism. I don't think it can survive. If enough people show up and vote, I think that whole model, you know, people are kind of done with that model, and they don't really want that. So we'll find that out next year.
If the world lasts that long, I mean, these guys can do a lot of damage.
Oh, boy, isn't that true?
I mean, you know, it's...
But it does raise a question that I had in listening to all this, listening to you speak about your book recently in Washington, D.C., and that it occurred to me right away that your explanation of the great skills that come from parenting and how absolutely vital they are in leadership in both in business and in government, that we really need those perspectives. And I see so many women who are reluctant to run for office because they say, oh, I'm not qualified. You know, this other guy is more qualified, even though, of course, he's not really. But women themselves undervaluing their experience with parenthood, and that if they could understand absolutely how vital and critical the experience of parenthood is, that that could maybe inspire more women to run and also inspire more of kind of more of the citizens to vote for women who still have some reluctance about voting women into office.
Well, I do think we've made a lot of progress on that front, don't you? I mean, it's been a huge change, really, and it's certainly at the level of local government, state government, and congressional level. I mean, the last election was more women than ever before. Okay, it was a woman's wave, really, coming into office. And a lot of very younger women and women who didn't have a lot of tons of worldly experience were in there. A lot of them did, but I think they were prouder of what they had done in their lives than the mixed kinds of lives they had led at home and at work and all that. Oh, there's more self-confidence now and more willingness to support women like that. The big obstacle, it seems to me, still is in America, is the top job, you know. And it may be having to do with the fact that we are also the world's heavily armed military power. I mean, we are now bristling military power with bases in 100-some-odd countries, you know, 100 military bases. So we think of our president increasingly as kind of a military leader, as a commander-in-chief. And there's no more masculine image than that or more masculine model than that. So I think the woman in America who wants to be at the top has the biggest, still the biggest problem, way bigger than, let's say, France or, you know, most of the European countries have already done it. Look at Germany. You didn't think of them as sissies. And they've had a hugely powerful woman for 14 years running that country. England has had a powerful woman leader, on and on. But we're the last, practically. And I think it's because we're so, I think we're militarized, you know. And it makes it harder to say, hey, kind and gentle really does work. Even though our military leaders are very, very aware of what you can do and not do in terms of being just telling people what to do. They have to have a chain of command, but they really understand quite well motivation and getting the best out of people, and they practice a lot of these skills that I'm talking about.
Right, and also the recent Secretary of Defense said, you know, you need to be building more on relationships and
strengthening we need
the
more
Department
diplomacy.
Of State, or you're going to have to give us more money for weapons to be fighting people.
Right, but they're begging for more diplomacy.
Right.
Negotiating, that is another skill I mentioned in the book. The modern leader doesn't just say, do it because I say so. People will say, sure, and they'll slink away, and they won't do it, necessarily. But you negotiate. You have to give and take. You know, here's how we're going to have to work this out. It's all about negotiation in parenting and in leadership. And that's what the military is saying now. You know, we need to get down and talk to people and figure out what we have in common. What can we get going that will help both of us, you know? We can't just order every other country around. You can't order people around like that. I had some very interesting conversations about that. In fact, one of the people interviewed on that was a defense official under the Reagan administration. And he said his experience dealing with his teenage daughter, negotiating, why can't I have the car tonight? How come I can't stay up past midnight? How come I can't, you know, do it? Negotiating with her, he said, was harder than negotiating with a Russian in Geneva on arms control. It was really very instructive.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and we're talking about the women in office, too. You mentioned Connie Morello, the U.S. representative from Maryland, who had all those children. But also Nancy Pelosi raised five children and then right. ran for office, and she's now the most powerful woman in the U.S. government. She's Speaker of the House, third in line to the White House. And if we do have impeachment of the president and vice president, she would become our first woman president.
Well, but, in that case, all this stuff would really be relevant because she knows it all.
Yeah.
And she is very, very famous for being able to understand how to build a majority, how to make the party move, how to motivate people to act together. And I mean, she's just a genius at manipulating people, you know, and managing people and managing her majority in the House. She's acknowledged to be the most impressive Speaker of the House of Representatives in decades. And I am convinced that it's from her, a lot of it. Well, she grew up with as a daughter of politicians, granddaughter of politicians in Maryland. So she learned that from her family, but also, I'm sure, a lot of it from raising her kids, who were very successful, by the way, proving that a mother can work very hard and still have great kids.
Yes, and I love that throughout your book, because so many of the people you interviewed were, you know, women who were in very high-level positions in entertainment and business generally in government, and at the same time were raising children. So,
right.
You know, that was kind of the big thing is women were coming out in the 1970s saying, oh, yeah, now we're getting our college degrees, getting our professional degrees, but can you balance doing all that, having a career, and having a family? And your whole book is testimony, well, yes, you can.
Yeah, you sure. It ain't easy, and it should be a lot easier, but with different policies. But, yes, you can, and the kids can be extremely well-raised.
Right.
In fact, it's like the old saying, you know, the busier person. There's an old saying in offices, you know, give the next job to the busiest person in the office. Because they're probably the most hardworking and the most efficient, and they'll handle it, you know.
Right.
So that's definitely partly true.
And I was surprised in reading your book that high-achieving women are no less likely to be married and have children than the average full-time working woman. So, you know, in my mind, still, the high-achieving women had to make that trade-off, and there would be less of them that actually had children. But that's no longer true.
It was true of the baby boomers, but it's no longer true.
Yeah.
The baby boomers, I think something like 25% of college-educated baby boomers never had kids. And that is not entirely voluntary. You know, they just had to keep working and had to, you know, it just was really harder for them to put it all together. But not anymore. There's more flexibility at that level in most corporations and institutions. There is more maternity leave, and there is more flex time. There is more accommodation for higher earning positions. And they don't have as quite the terrible trade-offs that we did, because I'm in that baby boomer generation. And I wrote my books because I was really seeing that conflict. But, yeah, I think it has gotten better. I think the big issue now is to make parenting more successful for lower-earning mm-hmm. women and men. We just, this tens of millions of lower earners in American economy don't have any sick leave. They don't have any maternity, paternity leave, parental leave. They don't get a day off, you know, if they get the flu or their kid gets sick or breaks an arm. They can lose their job if they don't show up. So it's still really brutal. And we definitely need a national policy. Child care, affordable child care, and we need parental leave so people can stay with their young children for a few months or several months, stay with them if they get really sick, you know. We just need those kinds of things. And they're routine in Europe, routine in every other developed country. So that's really what gets me, is how inactive this national government has really been terrible about doing anything about that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you talk about there's millions of workers who don't even get a single paid sick day in a year.
I know, it's insane. And when you think about it, I mean, I have a little cold right now, but what if my job is, I'm in the at home on a telephone. What if my job was to go to work in a restaurant?
Right.
And I was going to lose my job if I took my drippy nose and my cough into the restaurant. And
yeah.
That is what people are doing. So it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's brutal. I mean, with the, what if my child got really sick and I had to say, well, I can't afford a babysitter, but I got to go to work. If they found out that mother had done that, or found, they would be prosecuted. But they often have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pay the rent or leave the child at home. It's just horrible. We have it goes back to this thing that we don't respect the work. We don't say, oh, this is a real job that requires real time and real attention, and we've got to make sure it gets done right. We're really good at blaming parents if they don't do a good job, but we don't do a thing to make it easier for them. So that's
yeah.
My message.
Well, I was encouraged in reading your book. You talked about your two major impressions from all the research interviewing these parents, and also the research you did academically, that your two major takeaways were that mothers are everywhere in every profession and that they are changing the work world. So I think some of what we're seeing now that you're talking about of some greater flexibility on work time and some paid family leave and some flex time, some people more able to work from home, that all of those things I think have been helped by more women coming up further in the higher level executive chain, and the need for companies and organizations to change in order to keep talent of the women who have children at the table. So we've got some changes there, so that's a hopeful beginning. And now we know there's a lot more that needs to be done, particularly for the women who are not the high-income earners.
Right. Yeah, I do think, though, there's a couple of counter trends, which, I mean, there's more understanding that if you're raising a kid, that doesn't mean you're not devoted, or, you know, you could be a very talented, skilled person and be involved in raising children, and there's nobody apologizing, and I'm a mother now, you know, and I'm not going to... It's not the same stigma that people used to not even mention it, you know. They didn't even put their kids' pictures on their desks, you know. That's
mm-hmm.
really changed. However, what's going on, too, though, is that you've got these long, long 24/7 working hours, long working days. The pressures now on workers of all kinds, professional. In fact, the higher professional professions work longer hours now than
mm-hmm.
those. So that's going against what we're talking about. You know, how are you going to
mm-hmm.
do a job that asks you to stay there till 9 at night or be there on call all weekend with your cell phone, you know? So it's really, that's gotten harder in that respect. And I think, it, you know, we just don't have enough restraints on the capitalism, frankly, to make a workplace more humane.
Right, and part of that's the technology that's changed over the past
right.
10 or 15
right.
years. Now we got cell phones and laptops.
Exactly. They couldn't find you back in the day. And now
right,
they
right.
know where you are, and they're going to let you know when they want you.
That's right. And we used to at least have a sanctuary if we got on a subway car or on an airplane that, oh, good, well, you know,
yeah.
they can't get me here. It's like, well, yes, they can.
You can't even go to the South Pacific and get away.
That's right. Now they get people climbing these mountains all over the world, and they have their cell phones with them.
I know, looking at their cell phone as they trudge up Everest. I love it.
Right, exactly. So, so you're right
Sending
about
selfies
that.
Selfies back, you know, Everest.
Well, you did talk about a time when it was such a big stigma about being a parent that women were reluctant to have pictures of their children on their desk. So we're thankfully beyond that. But you raised the question in your book about, you know, how do you, as a woman who's taken time off to take care of your family, and how do you explain the gap in the years? Do you proudly proclaim, as one woman you talk about does, you know, I was a full-time mother for these years, or is that still kind of a stigma and something people kind of shy away from?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that is. You've got to mm-hmm. make it up a little bit about what you've been doing and make it more specific, the skills you had. And, I mean, I was on a committee choosing a new chief executive for an environmental organization. I was on the board. And one guy had a resume, and he was married to a doctor, and he had spent a few years as a stay-at-home dad. In fact, I think he was when he put in his application. But at the same time, he'd started all these, you know, outdoor organizations. He'd organized people in environmental things. Clearly, he had been active in the field of environmental work as a full-time dad. And but so I was very favorably impressed by his resume, but one of the men on the committee just tossed it on the table and said, ugh, stay-at-home parent, you know, dad.
Yeah, probably so worse for a man, you know, for a woman at least, he would think, well, that's what she's supposed to do. But
yeah,
for a man to
it was really disgusting because that was just ruling out a man who undoubtedly had the passion for the job and the and skills, you know. And we didn't even interview him. So that's still going on, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I have, as you might see if you have the book in front of you, I got recommendations in the back of the book of how you can put on your resume. Here's, I was managing this, managing that. But it is always good advice for people to say, I was active in a community organization, and I was active in the, you know, whatever it is you're interested in, and make it sound really businesslike. It doesn't hurt. I think that's important. But you never want to lie about it. If you did take a few years out, you better tell it straight and talk it up the way we're talking it up now, that you did do a lot of really challenging things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I love about both your books. I mean, if everybody in the country, particularly all the elected officials, because it would impact what they do in terms of policy, but really I would hope everybody in the country could read both your books on the price of motherhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's in print. Unfortunately, the other one's not in print anymore.
Oh.
It is in libraries.
Yeah.
You raise kids. It's in libraries.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So The Price of Motherhood, and then If You've Raised Kids, You Can Manage Anything. Read those two books, and you will get a much better understanding about just how complex and challenging the job of being a parent is.
To my great satisfaction, I've had a lot of feedback from women saying, you really gave me more self-esteem, more pride, more understanding of what I'm doing is important. So that is deeply gratifying to me. It's really why I wrote it, you know, that it makes people stand up taller and be aware that what they're doing is so valuable. It's so important. It is literally the most important job we've got in the economy. So anyway, that's if you make people feel pride, they're going to have more power, right?
Right, exactly right. And then, you know, you've got to shore up the argument on that. You quote Rick Edelman, the financial services executive, saying that mom's responsibilities include more than 17 different professions, you know, maintaining the home and assuring nutrition, crisis management, project planning. I mean, it goes on and on, the range of challenges and skills you need to be a parent.
That's right. It's way more so than most, and more interesting than most paying jobs, but it doesn't pay a nickel.
Right. Do you think it should be? Do you think we should be paying
parents? No. I think you do it by other social support systems.
Yeah.
I say no quickly, but, I mean, in many countries they do have a stipend for new parents because it is so expensive, the first years especially. But they don't try to steer people or social engineer them. You know, they say, well, in France, for instance, one of my favorite places, the mother and father get a stipend, and it doesn't depend on whether one of the parents stays home or not. They can use it if both of them are working. They can use it. Of course, they do have a parental leave for several months, so somebody can stay home for several months. But if they are both working after that, they still get this stipend which helps pay for childcare or nanny or daycare or whatever. If they're at home, it helps make up for the lost income of the parent who is staying home. They're not judging which way it ought to go. You know, what child you can do, you can choose your own favorite way of raising this child. But it makes it easier to pay the bills, which are huge when you have a new baby. So that's a good idea, I think. They do it in England. They do it all in countries just like ours. But, of course, we don't do it.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And possibly part of why we don't is we still only have, what is it, about 20% of women in the U.S. Congress now, still 80% men. It's still very
right.
heavily male. And the men often have the wife at home taking care of business, and so
yeah.
they're not weighed down, and they don't really understand still how much work that is. But as you point out, this is the most important work there is raising the next generation. You won't have an economy unless you have a next generation, and you want
yeah.
them to be raised as well and as intelligently and compassionately as you can.
Precisely,
and,
yeah. And I will say there is a correlation. I don't think, you know, I'm not arguing women are better than men or any such thing. However, there is a correlation between the percentage of women in a legislature and the family-friendly policies. The women put the money where their mouth is. They will have more family-friendly policies, like parental leave. In states where there's high women in legislatures, such as Washington State, let's say, compared to states like Pennsylvania, which have very few women in the legislature, it really matters. So I'm all for electing women.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, reading the book and all the great anecdotes that the women share with you as they shared their lives, or how did they manage, you know, being a parent and, you know, being, you know, high level in their jobs. What was the interview that surprised you the most?
Well, it's funny when you ask me that, I always think of this one amazing interview I had with a man, because I did not want to say it has to be a woman. You know, it just happens that women do this job more than men do. But I found a man who was so impressive and so moving, because he had been widowed when his children were like 5 and 7. So he hadn't helped, but he was the main parent, and he was really a hands-on parent. And they gave him Mother's Day cards and everything. He was the guy who was their emotional support. And he was a diplomat, and he became the chief negotiator for the United States in the Middle East in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter. He negotiated the big Middle East peace settlements, and there were several, including the Camp David Accords, the peace between Egypt and Israel. Huge deals. And he said, I could never have done that if I had not had that experience of dealing with my children hands-on. And he was so familiar with the emotions that the Middle East is full of, you know, grief and loss and anger and fear and these powerful emotions that affect the people in the Middle East, but also he had dealt with because of his sons, you know, loss of their mother. And it was just such a powerful story. I just almost get goosebumps every time I think about it, you know. And he didn't, you know, he was not a cold, by-the-book diplomat. He was a feeling person who had learned something big about human nature that enabled him to be a powerful diplomat. It's also a good story that we need diplomacy, you know, wise mm-hmm. diplomacy instead of bristling with military all over the place. Anyway, that was my favorite story, I think. And also it illustrated that a man, you know, is completely capable of doing all this.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. And
And
you tell a powerful story that I hadn't ever heard about when your son was a teenager and came in and you're working on a book, kind of, which is a lot of hard work by yourself, and he goes, oh, well, you know, he makes some disparaging comment about how your work
that.
Is worthless.
I'll tell that. You remember that. That's not in my book. Is it in the book?
Yeah, it's in the book. And then 3 years later, you're like this, you know, star author. And but why don't you
tell
the story?
He said. It was amazing. You know, he was one of those obstreperous ages of 15 or something, you know. So he comes in my office. He's in a bad mood, and I'm banging away as usual, sitting in my little office, you know, and he goes, "Ah, you have such a disgusting life. You just sit here all day. Ooh, I'd rather be dead than have a life like yours. Ugh, so boring and horrible." So that was what he said. Okay. I said, "Well, I'm doing something important, and you'll see someday, you know." Anyway.
Right. And by the way, this is the son that you gave up your job at the New York Times.
Oh, yeah. Never mind. I gave up my brilliant career and my famous self, you know, in New York.
Right.
But anyway, to become nobody, you know, for many years.
Yeah.
So that was the one, and I didn't get mad. I just said, "You'll see." Mm-hmm. Well, flash forward, and one day he comes into my office. The other funny part was he was working in a video store, I guess, a couple of years later in the neighborhood. He was behind the desk, and a woman came in with my book.
Oh.
He said, "Oh, she came in, and he was reading the book in the store. He had it in the store." And she said, "Oh, I know the woman who wrote that. How come you're reading it?" You know, teenage boy. And he said, "Oh, my mother wrote it." And she said, "Oh, yeah, it's a really good book." And James said, "Well, it ought to be. She worked hard enough." But the real payoff was when he came in about that time and again into my office. I'm pounding away again. And he says, "Mom, you know, you worked really hard on this. And you know, it wasn't, how did he put it? I can't believe I haven't remembered it word for word. But he said, you worked so hard and it wasn't clear, you know, what was going to happen. But it paid off, and I'm proud of you." And I just thought, my first thought literally was, "Well, I can die now. I've done my job. I've taught him the lesson, you know, never give up. Never, just keep at it, and you will succeed, you know, if you never give up."
Right.
So it was really a good moment.
Yeah, I love that story. That's so wonderful. And, you know, as teenagers, they can be so incredibly difficult. But then hopefully they grow out of that and become, you know, wonderful young people. So good for you for that. So we just have 2 minutes left. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts for anyone listening about wisdom around parenting and what it means in your life.
Oh, dear, I think I told my big story right then and there.
Yeah, that was a great one.
There is life after there are two and three, I'll tell you that. And now we're really good friends. I have a grown son, and it's just wonderful. And, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. That's definitely a message I can impart.
And you know, and everything is choice and everything is trade-off. You could have kept going with your career, a brilliant career at the New York Times. And
I could have, but I wouldn't have had any of the insights. And, you know, this is what that rabbi said. What was the name of his huge bestsellers? Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Remember, he wrote those really moving books because he had lost a son. The kid had died.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "You know, I have become wise, and you know, I've learned all this stuff, and I wouldn't have been able to write these books if I hadn't had that horrible loss. It gave him more wisdom." But he said, "I'd give it all up in 1 second to have my son back."
Right.
So, you know, that's pretty profound. So I feel like parents, you know, they do learn a lot of profound lessons because it isn't easy. It's not always smooth. But you do gain a lot of wisdom, and, you know, hopefully you don't lose your child, and you do, you know, come out with both your kid and your wisdom. I don't know. I hope that's not too heavy.
No, that's great. And, you know, you know, it's such an enriching experience, and there is nothing else like it. There's no way
nothing
you can learn
like
the
it.
Lessons that you learn as a parent.
Nothing.
It's incredibly powerful. Well, I encourage all our listeners to get and read the books, and the first one was The Price of Motherhood, and then the second, more recent one, If You've Raised Kids, You Can Manage Anything, Leadership Begins at Home. Well, Ann Crittenden, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for all your great work and for being with us today.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you. It's been great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.